Good evening. My name is Mofe Shaya Ayodele, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the History Department, it is my pleasure to welcome you to this evening's event, Social Justice in a World City, Rethinking the Flat World Thesis in Bangalore, India. Thomas Friedman, a renowned author and columnist for the New York Times, coined the term flat world, positing that the flattened world has resulted in a level playing field for everyone in an increasingly globalized world. His argument suggests that the globalization of the world has provided the opportunity for significant economic development in the global south. Bangalore, India, is a city that has skyrocketed to prosperity in the global economy and has been named India's Silicon Valley as a result of its surge in high-tech development. Multinational information technology firms are flocking to the region in an effort to outsource their IT services and generate products at a cheaper cost. Tonight, we will examine how the flattening of the world has affected Bangalore. The Bangalore model is export-based and thrives on offshore development directed at United States firms and consumer markets. Some scholars agree with Friedman that the Bangalore model serves as an example of how developing nations can benefit in a flattened world. However, others argue that the bulk of the benefit from this model is not seen by the majority of the local population in Bangalore. This lecture will explore that model and its practicality in creating sustainable and equitable cities in the global south. Michael Goldman is a professor of sociology and global studies at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. His latest book, based on a decade-long ethnography of the World Bank, is entitled Imperial Nature, The World Bank and Struggles for Social Justice in the Age of Globalization. Professor Goldman has been the recipient of numerous awards, including the Yale University Agrarian Studies Fellowship, Fulbright Fellowship, and the McKnight Presidential Fellowship at the University of Minnesota. His current research, titled Bangalore, The Making of a World City, focuses on the transformations occurring in major cities in the global south, with an emphasis on Bangalore, India. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. Now please join me in welcoming Professor Goldman.
Well, is this on? Can you hear me back there? Well, thank you very much. You know, I've just spent the last day and night before here, and I've never been to this part of Pennsylvania, but I really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed it. I mean, this is such a quaint location, and not just quaint in a small-minded way, but quaint and really a beautiful place. And not only that, but I think Dickinson College is really, and you know, I'm not paid to say this, but it's really quite a remarkable place. And in particular, the type of interdisciplinary work that seems to be going on, the fact that faculty really take pedagogy teaching seriously, as well as trying to stretch the boundaries of what teaching and interdisciplinary work is all about. At my home university, it's more like a factory. This would be a typical size of a class. So concerns or hesitations you might have about being here, just realize that this is, you know, it's a rare gem, a place like this and the type of education you get. As well, I think this forum is wonderful. I mean, maybe there aren't too many people from the community. Anybody from the community here? That is not from the U. But it's certainly nice to have this type of series where you actually bring people outside but also people inside to have debates about what's going on in terms of elections. And I think I was brought here maybe because one of the themes has been social justice and human rights. And since I've done some work on the World Bank in the past, it's a topic that I've been looking into. Today I'd like to talk about the presentation before me. The introduction was better than I can do on my own talk, so I really appreciate it. But out there in the world, there are a set of serious debates about sort of the world's problems. And so I want to highlight some of those debates and then take you right to the streets of, the streets and the surroundings of Bangalore to try to elaborate a little bit of what happens in the process of turning an Indian city, and it could be an African city or a Latin American city, into a world city. You know, how many people have read The World is Flat? Yeah. So, wherever you go around it's a global bestseller. Any airport, for example, not that this is a typical, but any airport you go to, literally around the world, Thomas Friedman's book is sold there. And if it's not, as somebody just brought up to me 2 days ago, it's because it's sold out. but it's not just that Thomas Friedman is brilliant, but that he's put his finger on a set of ideas that have percolated up, that seem to become dominant. And in my research on the World Bank, studying it ethnographically, you know, as a cultural phenomenon, the people who work there, you begin to realize that there's a coherent strategy out there, but maybe it's a coherent strategy that we need to interrogate, to think about. That is, what are the repercussions of lending huge amounts of money to build up a city into a world city? Okay. Now, it's important to appreciate some of the push behind it is what? Many people, particularly in the development expertise circles, feel that some of the core sites of the world's problems happen in cities of the global south, right? Typical representation of cities, whether it be Bangkok or Sao Paulo or New Delhi or even Bangalore, is that it's overpopulated, it's overly dense, it's a site for public health epidemics, on the one hand. What we call mega city problems. But in fact, a lot of lending for development by agencies like the World Bank completely avoided cities with the idea that cities were hopeless. And so they invested in agriculture, in industry, public health systems, yes. But rarely has it been, up until now, cities itself. But in a dramatic reversal, cities are no longer seen as sort of the site of stagnation, but the site of possibility. And so now I'm going to try to give you a presentation to look at that discourse, that idea of, is it possible to transform, through development, a megacity with its megacity problems, infusing lots of capital, and solving it with what we call world city solutions. World city solutions, international airports, decongested monorails, central business districts, investing in infrastructure, for example, in the case of Bangalore, that would sustain, keep in Bangalore for the long term, the information technology industry, because IT. The IT sector has boomed dramatically in Bangalore. And the argument is that if we invest, or if the World Bank and the Indian government invest in infrastructure in a city like Bangalore, water systems, electricity, transport, music halls, if you will, turn it into a world city, it will also keep and sustain that growth machine called the IT sector. That is growing at phenomenal rates. Providing tremendous number of jobs for engineers, and the argument is we can solve the world's problems by financing cities to set up the infrastructure in order to support these growth machines, whether it's IT or informatics or biotech or other forms of industry as well. And this is a new idea. Okay, and Thomas Friedman really put his finger on it. He realized, no coincidence, talking to CEOs, to World Bank leaders, and to policymakers in Washington and London and Tokyo, that something was happening. And there's something that is undeniable, which is the growth of these economic sectors, which are providing tremendous amount of wealth, producing tremendous amount of wealth. But interesting enough, the phrase "getting Bangalored," you ever heard that? Is really a phrase that's used in the United States, like in Minneapolis, for example, by professional class workers, white collar workers, who feel that their jobs are being outsourced to places like Bangalore. They're getting Bangalore in the sense that their livelihoods are being shifted over to India. So the question is, what is exactly happening? I mean, this global shift is definitely celebrated in the world is flat. You know, the idea is that stagnant and impoverished economic conditions in India and China can be turned by investing in what Friedman called the plug-and-play world, you know, which sort of geography and history no longer matter. That is, capital can wisely follow wherever the entrepreneurial spirit might flourish. And today it flourishes in cities like Shanghai and Bangalore. So the idea is the World Bank is going to finance world-class infrastructure. So the question is, what are the ramifications of Friedman's plug-and-play world for the people of a world city in the making? How is urban space and rural space, what we call the peri-urban, the outside periphery of a city, transformed in the process of building world-class infrastructure? And my third question is, do these type of investments generate the type of urban social relations that actually transform poverty-level incomes and living conditions into socially equitable, healthy world city of the 21st century? Okay. So the way I'm going to do this, because it's going to be very cryptic, meaning, you know, like bullets, and I apologize, but I don't want to take up too much time, and I want to leave plenty of time for questions, is I'm going to take you to what's considered a world city project. Okay, I'm going to explain quickly that project. Then I'm going to take you to a government agency where I spent time interviewing and talking to people inside that government agency. Why? Because the World Bank feels, and I mean, I think it's part of like the collective conscience of people in the development world, that if you're going to transform infrastructure, provide world city infrastructure, world-class city, you need a government that also becomes transformed. The lingo is good governance. Transparent, accountable, accessible to the public, accountable to civic forums, and their books are open. And one way to do that is to take government agencies and to make them open their books and then borrow money on the international markets and then follow international accounting procedures and what have you. That's just one example. But in a sense, making government more transparent. And then hopefully I have time to take you to one of the IT companies itself. One of the IT companies that's booming remarkably in India is called Infosys. And then by the end, I think I'll be able to wrap it up and tell you a story. Which one? There we go. Is that right? Okay. I'll skip. One thing is important. Bangalore is in southern India. It's on a plateau in between the coast. Chennai, Madras is somewhere around over here. Mumbai is over here on the coast. The weather, 9-10 months out of the year, can be incredibly humid and incredibly hot. But because it's on a plateau, it's a quite pleasant place to live. Historically, it's been what the Indian civil servants call the pensioner's paradise, sort of like the Florida of the upper Midwest or whatever, a place for people to retire, very pleasant. Since the early 1900s, it was also called the Science City. Some people say that because it's located far enough away from Pakistan and its so-called enemy, the last half of the century and any kind of weaponry that might shoot from there. But basically, a lot of the nuclear science, a lot of the military science, a lot of the aeronautics, a lot of the the first generation of high technology for India and for most of South Asia actually emerged from Bangalore. Now, it's very interesting, and the public-private issue will come up in a minute, is that the government of India financed world-class research institutions, IISc, for anybody who knows India, among others, in Bangalore, cultivated a whole set of generations of, world-class, if you will, nuclear scientists, mathematicians, philosophers, but mostly natural sciences and the physical sciences, who then began to work since the 1930s, and when the British were still in India, but certainly in the 1950s, in what's called public sector industry. That is, producing radar systems, producing airplanes, producing machinery, in factories surrounding Bangalore. That is, government-financed research institutions creating the engineers that worked in public-financed manufacturing sites producing not textiles or, you know, low-level or light manufacturing, but really the highest-level manufacturing that you could produce, highest level of engineers, in a sense, in Bangalore. And what's really interesting about living in Bangalore, I've spent time living there, is that surrounding the core of old Bangalore are these what you call housing colonies. That is, since the 1950s, when the Indian government set up a company or set up a factory, it realized that it also needed to set up housing. So you have these factories that are surrounded by housing colonies where everyone from the janitor all the way up to almost the head of the company would live. And on these grounds, you have public parks, you have public schools, you have religious shrines, you have, you know, if it's upscale, you might even have, you know, like a cricket, well, you have a lot of cricket courts and what have you. Are they called courts? Cricket. Pitch. Cricket pitches. In a sense, you have a lot of public life inside these housing complexes, inside these what they call housing colonies. Why? Because people couldn't, there was no market for building houses. The government built them. And by building them for the people who worked in the factory, people were paid very little. But because the food was, you know, in a sense, public clinics were there, schools were there, housing was there, in a sense, the government created an environment in which physicists as well as, you know, sweepers could live and, in a sense, socially reproduce, you know, in a not a biological way, but in kind of a socially hospitable way. That's one of the main reasons why Bangalore has always been considered one of the most livable cities in India. Okay. We take that picture. Now we move to the present. Well, before I go to the present, I just want to show you a typical street scene. Public, not just public schools, public parks, public sector jobs, but public streets. This is, if you will, a typical street. Actually, this is where, you know, everything from bananas to flowers, commerce, the liveliness of the city, surrounded by shops, but certainly pouring out of the shops. This is what you would call a typical street, if you will. This is what's happened in Bangalore over the last six months to a year, which is that the equivalent of Walmart for Tesco from England has set up supermarkets in Bangalore because catering to the new middle class. What's interesting is that they set it up right next to a fruit and vegetable market, and they basically charge less inside this what equivalent of a multinational supermarket than they do outside. And if you live in this part of, this is Malleswaram, if you live in this part of Bangalore, you typically, it's very common that in your neighborhoods, there somebody would sell fruit and vegetables on carts, and they'd yell out, you know, selling carrots, selling tomatoes, and then you come down and you buy them. Those cart vegetable dealers now go into Food World and buy them directly from Food World because the price is so low, rather than buying them from the farmers themselves, which is a small digression, but to tell you the type of shift that can occur in a middle-class lifestyle. How do they do that? Well, it's the same way that, it's basically they're undercutting the competition, right? That's what you learn in the streets as well as the business schools. And so they're lowering the price below the price that they should be selling it in order to get rid of the fruit and vegetable market next to it. But let me just tell you about the city in general. The numbers on the far left are numbers of square kilometers of a city growing. The square kilometers of in the 1970s of Bangalore was the size of Harrisburg, if not smaller. In the last 10 years, its population has grown to almost 8 million, and they predict it's going to grow to 8 to 12 million. The 8 million there, the size of 8,000 square kilometers, they're hoping to plan the city so they can grow, incorporate the villages and the towns around Bangalore in order to create a world city that is, and I'll explain to you in a second why, that can embrace all new industry and new condo complexes that are spilling out of Bangalore. And the planners are hoping that in the next 15 years that they can incorporate enough land around Bangalore so it'll become the third largest metropolitan area in the world. 8,000 square kilometers, which is phenomenal. I don't believe that it will happen, but I just want you to know that that's what the plan, urban plans are, to incorporate a tremendous amount of land around it. Well, how do you do that, and why do you do that? The engine of it before are the IT companies. In very short time, I mean, if you look, just in the last few years, the number of companies have grown dramatically, and the value of their exports have gone from 2 million just a decade and a half ago to 13.5 billion, and it's probably going to double soon. Tremendous amount of money. Why? Because they're producing, and I'll get to it at the end, tremendous goods and commodities that outprice, that means it's more affordable than that which we produce in the U.S. and Europe. And this is what the IT companies look like, just to give you a visual sense of what's growing up. Now, I want to take you to one of the World City projects, okay? One of them is the IT corridor, and that building, this is part of the IT corridor, which is to take thousands of acres of land that's settled by villages and towns, by farmers and rural India, because 80% of India is rural, right? And expand out an IT corridor. Now, interesting enough, and I'll tell you in a minute why, but the government laid out enough land, the equivalent of twice the size of Paris, in order just to build an IT corridor, okay? So laying out in advance a tremendous amount of land. Now, one of the problems of Bangalore is congestion. It takes hours to go from the airport to the downtown area or to the IT corridor. So much so, such that one of the plans is to build what's called the Bangalore-Mysore Infrastructure Corridor. Now, this, I thought, was the English countryside, the major, but in fact, it's an image. It's not real. It's an image created of what the highway would look like. Now, the idea is to decongest Bangalore as you invest in it, spread outward, because everyone complains about congestion. Now, I don't know if you can see this. Can you see this back there? Sorry. Mysore is the second largest city in Karnataka, the state. Bangalore is the largest city. The idea is we'll expand outwards into the rural in between here. Build a 130-kilometer expressway, a toll road, out this direction. And along the way, we will develop in ways to expand Bangalore out and offer incentives for companies from all over the world, particularly Europe and the U.S., to settle there and do their business. So, for example, they envision a corporate center, an industrial center, like building cars, an ecotourism center. Of course, you have to have ecotourism. And a commercial center where a lot of the corporate headquarters would be. And interestingly enough, a heritage center. What's a heritage center? I'll tell you. Most of this, it's important to realize that there are, in this area, about 1 million people who live, work on farms, live in rural towns and villages, are part of a rural economy, okay? So the question, of course, is what happens to these people who live along this area? Now, the project was given to an Indian investor from Pennsylvania. Wow, from Philadelphia. And it's really interesting because one of the researchers from India who was invited to Boston to give a talk went to Philadelphia to find the headquarters of this company. It's called NICE. A Nandi Infrastructure Corridor, but the acronym is NICE, and it was interesting because it was only like one room, one secretary, but this is a multi-billion-dollar project to build a multi-lane expressway with the idea of if you can go what normally takes 3 hours and take 90 minutes, then Google and Microsoft can set up campuses here and be able to sort of commute their workers back and forth, okay? At the same stretch, why not set up locations along there, special export zones, where companies don't have to pay taxes, but can settle there, so you industrialize this area along the highway. So the government gave the investor from Pennsylvania 7,000 acres of land to build this expressway at ₹10 per acre per year, 46 rupees to a dollar, so it's about a nickel, a quarter, 25 cents per acre. Per year, 7,000 acres that they would take from rural people in order to build this highway. Now, the guy said, look, I can't make money off a highway. So I need land to build these centers, as well as five private townships along the way. Cities, towns, townships, private townships. So the government gave him an additional, what's my math, 21,000 acres. So 7,000 acres for the highway, having to displace numerous people. He was given additional 21,000 acres, okay, at the same rate, in order to basically build these sites, own them, and then sell them, such that a Dubai real estate company has just put down a notice for $15 billion to own the rights to one township. Okay? So 25 cents per acre, right? And turned around, a township is being sold for $15 billion. Now the question is, what happens? What is going on in this area, and what happens to the people? Sorry, this is a horrible picture. I got to improve this. But this is how fertilizer is produced, if anybody is interested. But besides that, there's a lot of rural agriculture going on here. This is what most of this landscape looks like. The road, this is one of the roads. You know, basically, public buses are so overcrowded that people actually sit on top. This is a typical road, a typical site in the towns and the villages along the road. So what happens to these people? Well, let's just take the corridor itself. It's imagined that 200,000 people will be displaced. What happens to these people? New government agencies have been set up in order to acquire the land for this company to build this expressway, to decongest and develop this new IT area, right? Because that is not affordable, he's given the right to build five townships, private townships, which has never existed in the history of Asia. I don't know, maybe United States too. Privately owned cities. So each farmer and each rural person is now offered land compensation for the land, which they would give up. Then the idea is they'd either work in these townships or move to the city or work in the factories or what have you. Well, it's important to appreciate the power dynamics that go on in a transaction like that. Historically poor rural communities that grow, you know, food and fruit and vegetables and have a complex rural economy. You know, they're tailors, they're midwives, they're spiritual leaders, there's light manufacturing, there's weaving, there's textiles. But you know, nobody makes a lot of money in the countryside, except outside, you know, investors, are being given or offered $8,000, the equivalent of $8,000 to move. $8,000 can buy you maybe a hot dog stand, you know, on a street in a poor part of Bangalore. It certainly cannot buy you a house. It certainly cannot buy you a shop. And is turning around and selling to Cold War Banker, which is a real estate company, this land for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then a Dubai real estate company, you got the deal, right? So you can see the power dynamic is such that the government offers practically nothing to the initial investor for the land that it acquires for a small amount of money, $8,000, which may sound like a lot, but if you think about a family that's producing food and will eventually divide up that land to their children, $8,000 is actually not much. Just to give you an example, a typical hotel room in Bangalore is $400, right? So you spend a weekend there and you've blown your $8,000. Not that the farmer will go there, but it's a very expensive city. So the farmers are protesting. They say, this is crazy. Why should Coldwell Banker turn around and make hundreds of thousands of dollars on that same plot where I'm only giving $8,000? Well, in fact, what's happening is something even slightly more problematic than that. Because to understand the rural economy, you have to appreciate that typical ratio is that 80% of the population that lives in that rural area does not own the land. They work the land, they might have shops, they're busy in work and business and transactions, or they might be the spiritual, they might oversee the religious shrines, or they might be the school teachers, or they might be the nurse or the midwife, but they don't necessarily own land. The law is that only people who own land can get compensated. So if you keep that ratio in mind, I think it relates to most of India. That is, 20 of the people who are being displaced for these World City projects, only 20% actually get compensated. And of those 20%, they're getting compensated sort of unjustly, poorly, although legally. Because the government argues that the market price of the land before the infrastructure is built is quite low. Why is the value of the land at that moment so low? In part because the last 15 years, India has decided, with the help of the advice of the World Bank, but also on its own, to disinvest from the countryside. That is, not support the agricultural system, not support the rural economies, disinvest, not offer discounts for fertilizers or for credit or so. Make it difficult for the rural economies to thrive brings the value of land down. Farmers are desperate to leave. Karnataka, the state in which Bangalore exists, has the highest suicide rate of an endemic that's sweeping through India as the government decides to invest in cities and not in the countryside. As this countryside loses its investment from the government, the land becomes cheap. Then the government stands in and says, this is the market price, and we'll give you an extra grand just because, you know, because we care. And then that money typically can easily be lost within a short time. And you cannot reinvest that money successfully in Bangalore. I want to emphasize before I move on that I've got colleagues who are working along the international airport. Same story. Enough land was given to the airport to be the equivalent the size of Heathrow, the world's largest airport, but there's only one runway. It's a quite small airport. But nonetheless, it's located 35 kilometers outside of town. And the same story is happening. International investors have been invited to come in, build an expressway, and along that way build, you know, hospitality complexes, you know, seven-star hotels, industrial sites, corporate sites, all of which receive no tax, get a tax relief for, you know, the next, depends, 15 to 20 years in order to entice them to come in. We're doing research in these villages to try to understand what the price is that they're being asked, what the land is being acquired for, how they negotiate, what a power and authority people have to actually get a fair price back. Why? Because this is a pattern. For all the different world city projects that are going on in a city like Bangalore, including the center of town, the IT corridor, you need land. And in India, like Pennsylvania, but particularly in India, people live on land. There are economies on land. The fact that people survive means that there is a local economy. And in fact, I could argue and explain to you that it's a quite thriving economy inside Bangalore and outside Bangalore. But when you start to develop projects for the IT sector, you begin to build in a certain bias in government investment. Now, what do I mean? This is a... They're building, among other, besides this road, is a toll expressway. Well, even if we take this toll expressway, the only way to get to Mysore, the other city, the second largest city in Karnataka, is along this expressway, which is a toll road, which will charge a substantial fee. Now, I know most people will probably ride around it on dirt roads because that's what they do in Mexico, and you know, nobody wants to pay a toll. But if you live in those townships, you have to take that expressway to get into the city. So, In a sense, it's creating a monopoly, right? A monopoly built on the backs of the people who live in the countryside, okay? So the first step to appreciate is many of the World City projects, although they seem to have the glitter and the glamour of a European-style city, expressways, monorail, international airports, corporate enclaves, private townships, gated communities, that all seem to serve the needs of at least the elite, aren't isolated events that happen that only just benefit the elite. They can have a quite devastating impact on the majority. Okay, now there are certain things are important to appreciate is that 60 to 70% of the gross domestic product, you know, that is which gets produced in the city of Bangalore, is produced by the wide array of economies that exist in Bangalore. The silk industry, the textile industry, the farming community that lives on the periphery, They're inside downtown Bangalore. They're actually producing the cables for the IT sector. So there's a number of industries that exist and thrive, both in agriculture, in sericulture, which is silk, as well as, you know, light manufacturing inside the city. But every single investment for World City Building is for the benefit of the IT industry. By contrast, the IT industry employs about 3% of the population. It employs about 3% of the population. Secondly, they don't pay taxes because part of the incentive structure to bring Motorola, to bring Google, to bring Microsoft, and to stay is to offer them a campus with 24/7 electricity, 24/7 water, and a tax break, basically. So you have a multi-billion-dollar industry that is growing 40% a year. Phenomenal. You know, growing in leaps and bounds, not paying any taxes. And yet the city itself is borrowing hundreds of million dollars from the World Bank in order to build up the infrastructure for the IT sector. Okay? The argument, of course, is the IT sector offers jobs and benefits to the rest of the city. But right now, and it's 10 years in the success of the IT sector, it only supplies 3% of the jobs and pays no taxes. Now, let me just skip over and get to the actual... it's important to appreciate that the first pipeline that was built for the water system, the water system from Bangalore City outward was to the International Airport, which just opened in May. I just flew from there, a few months ago, right? And it's interesting because the first client for the huge multi-million dollar loan from the Asian Development Bank to build up the water system to offer it, you know, to the new world city, went straight to the airport, 35 kilometers out there, where no one lives, right? People only use it like for 20 minutes at a time. You know, you drink coffee, you go to the bathroom, and then you get on an airplane. And meanwhile, most of the population doesn't have access to water. This is a typical way in which sewage is dealt with. That is, it just gets dumped down the canals of the city. And this is the way in which the large majority of the population collects its water. So with those private townships are guaranteed water. With that international airport, they built the largest pipeline away from the city to the airport. But the vast majority of the population still has no access to water. Most people end up having to buy it from private water tanks, which at a high rate. Okay. The largest company, the most dynamic company, the most amazing company in India that's leading the growth strategy is Infosys. It has offices all over the world, including Minneapolis, and its growth has been phenomenal. If you can see it, its assets, you know, from a few million to multi-billion. What is this industry? This industry, does anybody remember, old enough to remember Y2K? You know, right in the year 2000. Europe and American companies were panicked because we thought that all the computers would just crash because of the 00 problem, year 2000. So they hired a bunch of Silicon Valley engineers at, you know, $60 an hour, $120 an hour to fix the problem. Fix the problem in just every single mainframe, you know, tinker with. A couple entrepreneurs from Bangalore went to Silicon Valley and said, hey, We can do it for a fraction of the price. You pay us $30 an hour. We'll pay our engineers $13 an hour, and we'll make the difference, right? Immediately they became multimillionaires, and they realized that they had a niche market. Once they were inside Silicon Valley, you know, California companies, they said, "Hey, we can do that at a fraction of the price." And in fact, they could. Call centers is one example, but they manage. Today, they manage up to 70% of Fortune 500 companies' data. And if you think of insurance companies, what is an insurance company except data? You know, files, cases, claims, audits. I mean, it's also people trying to sell you insurance. It's also advertisements during the Super Bowl. But besides that, a lot of insurance companies, American Express, the blue-blooded card. What is a credit card except data? Infosys figured out a way to offset the excess costs of professional class workers in America for Northwest Airlines, American Express, for Best Buy, cut out human resources, cut out accounting, and do it in Bangalore. And they make billions of dollars from it. I mean, it's brilliant, and it's innovative. This is the Infosys campus. If you want to know what they do with their water, well, here's the pyramid, you've got a swimming pool, you've got a golf course. They put in a gym, like they have in Silicon Valley, until everybody started using it from like 9 to 5, and they immediately said, hey, wait a minute, and they wouldn't let people in the gym until after 5 o'clock because, there was a gym, there was like a cafeteria that was open 12 hours a day. People would just hang out. Then they closed the cafeteria until, 2 hours of lunch, and they closed the golf course until the afternoons because people were having a good life. But basically, these are sprawling campuses. I'll skip that picture, but that's where all the secret data is being held. Actually, maybe I'll tell you. When my graduate student, while I was talking it up with the manager, I was getting escorted through the Infosys campus. We passed the brains of the institution, and we took a picture. And this is a map of a particular multinational corporation, and all the white spots, you can probably hardly see it, are all the different sites around the world where their data, like American Express, is constantly being moved, right? Because if American Express data disappears one day, there's no American Express, right? So Bangalore is susceptible to, a bombing, electrical outage, or what have you. To ensure that they don't lose their credibility, they constantly move data around the world. It's pretty phenomenal. So, and it's like backing up in 1,000 places, except it's all American Express data. I know I'm not supposed to say American Express. He told me not to say which companies, but just to give you a sense that Fortune 500 companies rely on Infosys in a profound way. But what about the people who live in Bangalore? Interesting enough, this is a convoluted way to get to a cryptic point. But this is the punchline. Okay. That is. For all the water they consume, for all the electricity they consume, the monorail, the airport, the private townships that their engineers want to live in, for all the land that they are accumulating and the public resources given to them by the government, what are they doing in terms of reinvesting in Bangalore City? Well, they're not hiring because the engineers come from all over India. I mean, they are hiring 70,000 engineers, which is quite a lot. But they've stopped hiring. Now they're hiring in Manila, Mexico City, and Eastern Europe. Their campus, which is 79 acres, is that huge campus I just showed you, meaning 80 acres is a huge campus, just to give you a sense. And you have to remember that what is the whole process of IT? That means an engineer in a cubicle working across the room from a dozen other cubicles, moving, doing data work, doing software coding, and moving across the internet, to different parts of the world. That's a lot of what happens. They don't need a lot of space. If you look at the annual report from 2006 of Infosys, it'll tell you what they're doing in terms of investing in Bangalore. If they're not creating jobs, if they're not paying taxes, what they are doing is buying land. They realize creating land banks was a key challenge, but one of the key strategies of keeping this corporation in profit. Which means that their engineers are constantly cycling out, in an emphasis and out, taking the knowledge and then setting up their own firms or moving to, among other places, Minneapolis or London, taking their skills elsewhere, getting paid better. Infosys has competition from all over the world. It's a brutal world out there. As the cost of living goes up in Bangalore, they realize the best investment is not more engineers, because profit rates are slowly dropping, but buying land. So what I developed this thesis, and I feel like what's happening is that the main business in Bangalore is not IT at all, because they hardly run business there. I asked the Infosys people, because the World Bank people told me that the great thing about the IT sector is that they would turn the IT sector onto the government, and the government would employ telematics, computer systems to become more efficient, to become computerized, more efficient, e-government. So the government would be transformed in the process. But when I went from government agency to government agency, there were no computers being used. So then I went to the people in Infosys, and I said, are your clients the government of India? And they said, are you crazy? Why would we have a contract with an Indian client that will basically be in rupees when we can have a client in the U.S. or Europe in dollars or euros? You know, less than 2% of our clients are actually in India. Meaning that even the development project of making government more rationalized, more efficient, more professionalized is not the business that these people make money on. They're not interested in that. And the government, of course, is not interested in it either. What they are interested in is acquiring huge plots of land. Why? Investment. Speculation. In the last 3 years, under pressure from the World Bank, but certainly on the initiative of the Indian government, they've allowed foreign companies to buy land for the first time in Indian history. So now you have Walmart that says, we can't set up shop, remember that supermarket, without huge warehouses, right? Carlisle, right? Isn't that what this is all about? Huge warehouses, which requires large plots of land, cheap. We need roads, we need warehouses, we need airports, and we need ports. So now you have international companies coming in with the help of the government, subsidized land given to them. Most of this land was given to them for a penny, practically, with the idea that the IT companies will create tremendous economic prosperity. But what the IT companies are doing are displacing, not just the IT companies, but the infrastructure that they require. Hundreds of thousands of people inside the city and on the periphery of the city in order to build the world city, to bring in professionals from all over the world to live in places where people from India, from Bangalore in particular, once lived. You have an interesting circuit that brings in other world cities. And I'll give you an example. I was in Dubai. In Dubai, if you've ever seen pictures of Dubai, it is a crazy place. They're building one skyscraper after another, hundreds of skyscrapers, one after another. It's phenomenal. Who's building those buildings? It's interesting. A lot of people from, among other places, outside of Bangalore, displaced from their rural economies, are getting on jumbo jets from Bangalore Airport, flying to Dubai and living in worker camps that Human Rights Report has called the equivalent of slave-like conditions, producing, you know, skyscrapers in the world city of Dubai, from which the surplus goes into the hands of what has now become the largest real estate sites in the world. The real estate capital gets reinvested in private townships on the periphery of Bangalore, which displaces thousands of more workers. And so it goes. What you have in a world city in the making, as crazy as this may sound, with all the attractive business seemingly going, being sucked out of the Midwest and going to Bangalore, is what you call the Gini coefficient. Basically, the income ratio of the richest 20% in society as related to the poorest 20%. Just 15 years ago, or 18 years ago, was 5-1. Bangalore was a fairly equitable society. Do you remember at the beginning I told you that most of the jobs in Bangalore were in fact created by the government? These large companies were created, really high-end manufacturing, housing colonies, public schools, right? All that is gone. All the public sector now is doing, a la the neoliberal agenda of the World Bank, is to privatize land, privatize infrastructure, which means put it in the hands of individual or corporations or individual investors, in a way that cuts out those schools, those parks, those religious sites, the public spaces, the cricket pitches, etc., as well as the jobs. So as land is being freed up, land is being scooped up in real estate speculation, people are becoming more and more poor. So that now the gap between the rich and the poor is 20-1, and that's 2 years ago. My guess is much, much higher. And I'm not trying to emphasize the riches, how the riches are getting rich. What I want to emphasize is the mass amount of displacement that goes on in the name of creating a world city for which these people, the majority of the population, can no longer afford to live, such that they have to go to Dubai to find jobs, creating extra surplus value, if you will, extra value in the real estate sector, which then comes back to Bangalore and bites the next generation in the proverbial behind, right? Now, there are signs all over Bangalore: do not grab public property. You know, there is a street fight, if you will. Some of the graffiti from some of the social movements, save Bangalore. Now, this is actually in Kannada, the local language right over here, but for us, save Bangalore from the land mafia, water crisis, and of course, the obscene movies. Because, multiple social movement agendas collide oftentimes. And you find at every, now you have a cyber cafe in every street corner, but you also, it also doubles as a real estate agency, which means that right now, I met people who worked at the research institute, physicists, professors and scientists who lived in Bangalore for many generations, who have a decent job, work for the government, who are now having to sell their houses and move out to the periphery because they can't afford to live in Bangalore. So, what does it mean to build a world city in order to reduce poverty, to make it more livable, if the population that lives there can no longer afford to live there? Now, this picture really got destroyed. That's a mass of people, now just a mass of dots. I'm going to end here. This is pictures from a place called Nandigram. That's a special export zone in SEZ outside of Calcutta, which where a Tata, a car company, was actually the Tata auto company was supposed to produce the Nano, the $2,000 tiny car for the new middle class Indian. Well, it required a tremendous amount of land from farmers, and so the farmers protested. I don't know if he's a farmer or a student, but I can't go backwards. What's happened across India and as well as in Bangalore is that people have responded. That is, that when it became clear that all this excitement, exuberance around transforming our cities into world-class cities meant the active displacement of the large percentage of the working class of the people the rural communities, as it's been happening in the last 5 years, people have started to protest. And they've organized themselves in different ways. Unfortunately, one of the most powerful movements in Bangalore today, and in fact, Bangalore is not called Bangalore. Did you know that? What's it called? Anybody? Bangaluru. Why? Because that's the name of Bangalore, not in English, but in Kannada, the local language. What's happened, unfortunately, sort of like our fundamentalisms that emerged in the United States and around the world, is that one community displaced by another community, or different communities displaced by these processes are beginning to be pushed up against each other in very combative ways. There have been tremendous amount of, when I was just there, in the middle, the city was closed down because a couple of Hindu fundamentalists had thrown pig's heads into a couple of mosques on Friday night, a holy night, and have basically threatened to run out the Muslim community. Why? Because more and more of the community there's a palpable anxiety in this world city. And it's not because of the pollution, it's not because of the congestion, it's not because of the expensive cappuccinos. It's because the only way to maintain those industries, that is, allow them to make profits without giving back to the city, is to destroy the local economy. Destroy the local economy. I mean, I said in a class today that it's so interesting that some of the most important world city projects in Bangalore are transport, monorail, airport, highways. Somebody did a study that showed that 50% of the people of Bangalore use three main forms of transportation: foot, bicycle, and public bus. None of which use those transport facilities. So why are we borrowing hundreds of millions of dollars to build infrastructure that serve only 3% of the population? And if that is a world city, then maybe, and this is where I basically end, it seems to be to loop together the idea of turning a global south city into a world city has its serious development implications. And I'll just stop there. Thank you. Now I promise we're not going to run into the mud fest that's going to happen on TV in a short time. So don't you worry. Just consider this a preview to the show. But I think there'll be some questions.
Professor, I'm Dave Anderson, a senior IBM major. What you're talking about right here, the aim of your PowerPoint presentation is something that me and some of my friends have been working on. This is everything I need to see. The problem I'm running into right now is I can't explain it from either top down or bottom up without people understanding what I'm saying. I started out at the beginning of the week trying to explain it with all the ideas, putting it together, and people. The feedback was, I have no idea what you're talking about.
The feedback I get all the time.
And now I've tried to go the other way and try to explain from the bottom up, yeah, and now people don't have no idea what I'm talking about either way. And what I need help with, I just can't explain it. I can't find that careful medium in terms of what we're working with here. Or we can't find that careful medium.
Yeah, I can't either. It's very complicated. I appreciate the question. I'm happy to write your term paper.
No.
I think you've really got a handle on it. Bottom up is the question. Look, if you're interested in development, if you're interested in really fighting the problems of these cities and them, you know, constantly be transformed, I would think that you would start where people are at, not where people you imagine in Washington should be. Where you imagine people should be is riding a monorail or working in the IT sector. Every taxi cab driver that I met hoped, displaced from the rural economy, hope to go and work in a call center. You know, the discourse and the path have been narrowed. The question is, and what's your name?
Dave.
You don't have time before your paper's due on Monday, but I think that if you could sit cross-legged or imagine sitting cross-legged in downtown Bangalore, you know, which is actually where a lot of the manufacturing is. They want to turn it into a central business district, you know, an opera house, pubs, and that's where actually a lot of the Muslims live. So it's really interesting that now the BJP, which is the Hindu right-wing party, runs the city, wants to turn the downtown area into a central business district, which means get rid of the Muslims and their businesses. If you sit cross-legged there and ask them, well, what do you need? They would not say an expressway, a private township, an international airport, or subsidies to the IT sector. They do produce cables for the IT sector. They might say, hey, look, why don't you tax them 15%? And then that money can go to build up the infrastructure. We don't get electricity but a few hours a day. We don't mind, but we could use a couple more hours of electricity. What they really need, they have no access, interesting enough, there are no public hospitals with intensive care units in Bangalore. There are no public hospitals with intensive care units. That is, if you have a serious injury, you have no place to go. And yet at the same time, you know what, besides the IT sector, the fastest growing industry is in Bangalore? Medical tourism. They have huge hospitals that they're building, private hospitals with private ICUs. See what I'm saying? So if you go to the community that actually is already working in an industry, they would say, we need a clinic near us because our kids are sick. We need time. We need money to be able to send our kids to school. We need a little bit more materials and a kind of a subsidy to offset the fuel prices that are going up. Because of all the farmers that have just gone out of business because their land has been taken from them, the price of food has tripled and quadrupled. We cannot afford to eat, even though we work 12 hours a day. How can you help us on that front? That's very different than the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank saying, hey, we can bring in the German and the Swiss to build the airport, to build the highways, the new Pennsylvania investor, right? See how there are different visions of the world, different problems that they see? If you ask a middle-class expat, American, you know, a professional who goes to Bangalore regularly, what's the biggest problem in Bangalore? Traffic. But then you realize that 50 to 75% of the population never use those roads. Traffic is not the biggest problem. It just seems to be the biggest problem because the people who are in the conversation are policy elites who don't necessarily even come from Bangalore. So the bottom-up argument would be, I would say, read Thomas Friedman and realize, with all due respect, that he spent most of the time in the golf course interviewing CEOs, and his vision of the world is flat, you know, that these networks exist. Those networks exist. But he didn't have a single sentence that explained what's the effect in the local community, the non-elite local community. And the way I see it, and it's not predictive, it happened this way, because nobody could predict where the IT industry would invest. They're investing in real estate, sweeping people off the land. What can you do about them? Well, you prohibit it. You tax them. There's ways to prevent companies from actively sweeping people off the land. And who does the sweeping? The government agency. You can't just bully people off land in India. You actually have to have a government agent do it, you know, through legal means. Why? Well, just to get a little more complicated, around the international airport, 20 years ago, the Dalits, which are the lowest caste people, the most, you know, the people who are most discriminated against, were in and around Bangalore, were given plots of land near where now the airport is. And they were given the land, the idea that you can farm it, but you can't sell it. Meaning, you know, you can't be swindled or you can't just leave it. You will be farmers. So they've been productive farmers. They've come up in phenomenal ways. Their children, some of them, are actually going to engineering school. And that is the land that now through, you know, kind of the hocus pocus of changing the laws, the government has been actively pursuing because it's right near where the international airport is. So there's an example of you know, I mean, you know, the government could give land to people like the Dalits continually, allowing them to farm, producing for the needs of the urban consumer. Their kids could imagine, some of them can actually go to engineering college. That is remarkable. Those are the people who are being displaced. So you can see two development kind of philosophies, you know, at loggerheads. Do you want to follow up on that? You're allowed to, I think. You asked a good first question. You're allowed to ask a good second question.
We've identified two markets, autism awareness and the fly fishing community in the Cumberland County area as two of these exact things that are going to, you know, start from the bottom up, you know, because the fly fishing community in the Carlisle area is such an important part of that bottom up, you know, because it's one of the reasons why Carlisle is a spot on the map. You know, people come from around the world for the greatest fly fishing in the world in the Cumberland County area. And so
that's where I'm going later on tonight.
And so what I need help with, or what I think we need help with, is how do we get into better habits of taking this all the way, like, up the ladder? Like, how do I get comfortable with making, or we get comfortable with making this sales pitch, quote unquote, and then being able to take it up and up and up, and being able to market this to as high as it can go?
I don't know about that one. That's a tough one. Okay. That's above my head. You know, it's all about context. The example I give is typical of what's happening in Indian cities. People are being actively displaced. One person wrote it, middle-class bourgeois environmentalism. Middle-class asceticism. That is, that all of a sudden the poor are not just poor, but they're dirty. And not only that, but they disrupt the harmony of the city. The future of a world city can't have these people in the city. So that's, you know, that's a cultural phenomenon that has emerged. I'm asking the question, how did this cultural shift happen such the majority of the population of a city are considered rubbish? In order to replace that image, with the one I gave you at the very beginning, with an image that to make it a world city is the only hope for India. I mean, that's crazy, but that's legitimate. You know, if you go in the circles of, you know, World Bank policymakers and the urban policy elites, I heard it 1,000 times, and Bangalore is the model. So I think what you have to do is you have to sort of just get your feet dirt, you know, your shoes muddy, and really understand what is the local economy and what might people need. And then you have to put that in a context larger than that and ask the question, well, why are people so resistant to it? Now, you know, there are reasons why people might be against one economy versus another. But what's attractive to me about Bangalore is that we've all been seduced by it, you know, that we all look to Bangalore as the model for the future of cities in the global south. And so I'm sort of putting the brakes on that. And I'm not saying that every city is happening like this, but before we do the Shanghaiification or the Banglerization of a city, let's stop and ask, well, what do the people of the city need? Let's not demonize the people of the city. Assume that they're the reason why the city has ills. Interesting enough about Bangalore is Bangalore was quite a livable city until now. So you can't even blame the people. But now the poor are being blamed for the problems of the city. The poor don't drive, for example. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. You talked about the World Bank earlier and disinvesting from the countryside. I was wondering if, A, is that part of the reason we're in a world food crisis, and B, has the World Bank now done anything to kind of go back on that since we are in a world food crisis?
That is an excellent question. And, you know, you kind of need to let it breathe a little bit. And I need to figure out the answer. No, you can't point to one thing and say that's the reason, okay, first of all. But you can point to a certain set of trends. So one specific one that you're, quote-unquote, feeding on is the fact that to produce the world city, you have to sacrifice the rural, okay? Now, remember that 70-80% of the population lives in the rural, and they don't all live in, you know, backwards 19th century hovels. It's a quite dynamic place, okay? I mean, I can't describe it. I need, you know, 45 minutes. But don't assume that because they're rural, like rural Pennsylvania, right? Don't assume because they're rural, they're poor, backward, they have no capacity to produce. But that's the assumption. If you want the city to grow, it has to grow. It has to grow outward. So they're basically, I was sitting in a village. It was quite amazing. I had two multinational corporations. You know, I spaced on the name, so I can't remember what they were. The equivalent of Google and Motorola. Right across from the IT corridor highway, and I had this village panchayat, which means village leader, show me. And he pointed across the highway, and he said, those are our fields. I said, those are your fields? And I realized, wow, you know, 10 years ago, those were his fields. And then he turned and he said, this is our village. And I turned around and I didn't see a village. You know, I mean, this is where they lived. This is where they farmed. And their land was, and he took me out to a restaurant and we had this wonderful meal. And I remember it was spinach and paneer and some dal. And he said, this spinach we used to grow here. You know, we used to grow this dal here. Everyone in this part of Bangalore knew us for the spinach that we grew. And that's all gone. A. B, the price of spinach is skyrocketed. C, these people are underemployed and, you know, have all the social problems of displaced farmers, you know, alcoholic, you know, basically living in the slums, severely underemployed. What's happened to what he called the most prosperous villages on the outskirts of Bangalore is sad, you know. So you undermine the rural economy. Why? Because it's not, you know, it doesn't fit within the discourse. It doesn't make sense. Even though they're producing the food for the world city, right? Okay. Secondly, there's an important policy that the World Bank, yes, and the IMF have been pushing for decades, but particularly the last 15 years, and it has disastrous consequences in Africa, throughout Africa. And that is that countries that have owed substantial amount of money for these similar types of projects that countries cannot pay back for, highways, airports, you know, infrastructure that's built by Germans, and yet, you know, they need to be paid in Deutschmarks, and you live in a peso economy, it's very expensive to pay German Deutschmarks. Why aren't Mexicans building that road, or why aren't Nigerians building that road? Why aren't, you know, Ghanaians building the road for Nigerians, and why aren't the Nigerians helping with the water filtration plant in Ghana? 65 years of World Bank development, you know, they've been around for 65 years, you don't see any of that. You will never see a single World Bank loan going to the Ghanaian engineers to finance, you know, to help Nigeria, and Nigeria to go help Ghana, Tanzania, Kenya. Nothing like that. It's always Germans, Japanese, Americans that are being contracted to provide the infrastructure for these countries. These countries are becoming further and further in debt because you can't pay back the loans fast enough. You can't produce things for the global economy enough to pay back these loans and still eat, right? So what do? They grow export crops, or they get displaced for urban infrastructure, meaning that fewer and fewer people are growing for the local market. More and more people are growing for the export market, like for us, coffee, tea, sugar, cotton. And it makes it more and more difficult for farmers to survive and for people in the cities to be provided food. 15 years of World Bank policy in highly indebted countries in Africa saying that you just stop subsidizing farmers, because that's not free market, and you start investing in infrastructure that will help, you know, these particular sectors, have led to you know, rashes of tremendous famine. And I told the story in one of the classes, so I apologize. But I was in Johannesburg, South Africa, during the World Summit on Sustainable Development, 2002. In 2002, there was, in southern Africa, a famine. Thousands of people died. What happened? The governments of southern Africa were forced. Now, these are Malawi, Zambia, poor, weak countries. Were forced by the World Bank to eliminate their farmer subsidy. What's a farmer subsidy? It means when farmers have a bad crop, the next year, the government will give them free or cheap fertilizer, seeds, credit to borrow, you know, to borrow until the next harvest or so, which banks won't do. Eliminate that subsidy. And what happened? Farmers could not produce, and there was widespread famine throughout southern Africa. When the chief of agriculture, you know, inside the World Bank, was surrounded by African journalists at this meeting, it was a wonderful moment in the history of the World Bank. And I don't know if he still has his job. He said, "It's our fault." It was like there was a pause, because that's what every journalist knew, you know, that it was their fault. But they said, you know, he said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, Europe and the United States, who export the philosophy of free market, neoliberal, you know, cut out all tariffs and subsidies, open markets all around, no subsidies to anybody, has an annual subsidy of $350 billion to their farmers." Right? Why not? Keep your farmers afloat. Keep food cheap. I mean, I'm not against that personally, but that's against the Washington philosophy. Gets exported and imposed on southern Africa such that there's a famine. And he said what we needed to do is force the European Union and America first to eliminate their subsidy, which, of course, the World Bank has absolutely no power in the United States to make that declaration, let alone that policy, right? But it was an interesting moment because it revealed a lot, that he knew that the devastation of a policy made from a, you know, an economist trained at MIT, you know, 35-year-old, you know, imposing a policy on Malawi has led to the death of thousands of people because it's totally irrational. Those governments kicked the World Bank out temporarily and created a subsidy. In the last 5 years, Zambia and Malawi have been exporting their food to neighboring countries. You know, that kind of imposition of policy is totally ludicrous and is part of the problem of the world food crisis. The other part is, as somebody here told me that, she here said that she was, now where were we? What country? Help me. It wasn't Rotary Club. It wasn't you. It was somebody about wheat. Who's here? She's not here?
Mongolia.
Where? Stand up.
Mongolia.
Yeah, the USDA with, you know, and I'm sure the World Bank's not far away. I apologize. I can't remember anything. What, you know, promoting a policy of that wheat that's highly subsidized in America, where's that wheat going? It's not just going to bread factories in the United States. It's being exported and dumped in Africa and in Mongolia, where the USDA and the World, and I think also the World Bank, is offering farmers incentives, wheat farmers incentives in Mongolia to stop growing wheat because the market says that American wheat is cheaper. Can you imagine with fuel crisis, the fuel, price of fuel going up so high that planes now have only like 10 minutes of extra fuel in their airplanes, you can somehow still afford to move wheat from Illinois all the way to Mongolia and it be cheaper than what the Mongolian farmer produces? You know that's not a free market. You know that it's been completely skewed to benefit the American farmer and to undermine farming in different parts of the world. Why? Well, for the wheat industry. Okay, so that's good for the Americans. The question is, why is that development policy? And that's what I leave you with. Why is that rational development policy to displace farmers? What do people need but food? When you displace farmers and you have a banking crisis like we have right now in Malawi or Mongolia or Kenya, the country gets wiped out and farmers don't produce and people starve. In this country, people get kicked out of their houses and the effects are not televised and won't be discussed in the debate today. But people do get kicked out of their houses. You know, food banks throughout America have seen a fivefold increase in people coming to the food banks just in the last 6 months. You know, there's also a serious problem in the United States. But when it hits a place like Malawi or Mongolia or Kenya, it has a devastating effect.
So why is this development policy, and is it rational? You know, obviously that's what I'm asking here. Yeah, one more question, two more questions? The debate's not on yet. Yes, I think there's a microphone. This is being televised.
My name is Neil Diamant. I teach political science and law and society here at Dickinson. A lot of what you describe applies equally to China, which I happen to focus on. Developmentalism, displacement of farmers, and so forth. But one key difference is that Indians can vote in addition to protesting. So I just wonder if you could mention a couple sentences, because there are more questions that want to be put forth to you. People in India can vote. Do they vote people out of office for pursuing these development policies? Yes. Or do they buy into the policies and do nothing about them?
That is a very good question. Because Indians are proud, like we are proud of what, I don't know, the world's greatest democracy, or what's our slogan? In India, it's the world's largest democracy. And people are proud of it. But that's, is anybody from India here? But then there's always a comma, you know? But... And in the case of, yes, China and India actually are very similar. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't get this on the news in the newspapers, the mainstream press. But there's enough information circulating to suggest that even before the Olympics, and certainly after the Olympics, or way before the Olympics, widespread rural protests around massive displacement around, you know, these type of projects. Massive displacement. But it is hard to vote in China. In India... people do vote, but, you know, how to explain it simply. Well, let me just tell you that there are three parties right now in Karnataka, three separate parties. Each have ruled. The third party, which is the Hindu right-wing party, the BJP, has just taken office just this past year under the banner of cleaning up corruption. Okay? But, excuse me, what do they mean, cleaning up corruption? Well, as it turns out, according to friends of mine who do research in Bangalore, if you look at the people who have acquired a substantial percentage of the real estate in these areas where rural people have been displaced, and not just an expressway has been built, but land on the edges of the expressway, this for the older generation, this is how Ross Perot made billions of dollars. You know that, right? He knew where the Dallas-Fort Worth airport was going, and he bought land, cheap rural land along it, before the highway was built, and then he made millions and then billions of dollars. Remember Ross Perot? He ran for president. Okay. Because Bangalore is basically a small city, very small city. Everyone knows everybody. You know the last name, and you can find out who bought land in what areas, and everyone knows, and you realize that every single political party leadership has swept up large percentage of that real estate to make money off it. So what you have is you used to have opposition. You know, the Congress Party was in power, which was the dominant power. And then all of a sudden the opposition was saying, hey, you're stealing real estate. And then they were embarrassed, they were caught, they were kicked out. Then the second party took power, and they were kicked out. Now the third party has taken power, and now everybody knows that they basically have distributed the wealth, which means two things. One is that the political party leadership, so the equivalent of the Democratic Republican parties, and it is very equivalent, have basically jumped into the market. I mean, why not? You know, they were bureaucrats, they were civil servants, they were party officials, they made a little bit of money on distribution of water and goods and stuff like that. They would buy votes. Now they're buying votes. They're spending millions of dollars buying what's called vote banks, buying votes, whole communities, where they basically pay people on their way to the voting booth, actually on their way out of the voting booth, to vote for their party. I know it sounds depressing, but it's true. It's sort of like the chick controversy in the United States. You know, it's like the 12-hour waits in Florida for African Americans to get into their voting booths. It's similar, except people are actually being paid to vote for certain ways. But the worst, I don't care about that part. The worst part is that opposition parties, which is really the vitality of political life in India, is now disappearing slowly, or quickly, rather, because there's so much money to be made by selling land that the government owns or controls. Most of the land is under government or under village land. To selling it to outside brokers, there's so much money to be made that political parties are now, unfortunately, buying into it. Real estate is really the business of politics and economics in Bangalore, and nothing else. It's sad. But of the 25 parliamentarians, they're called parliamentarians, of the state in Karnataka, 23 were from the real estate industry. And the real estate industry did not exist 7 years ago. So it's all, I don't know the equivalent, you know, of Alaska oil or, you know, the Sierra Nevada's gold. You know, real estate is now that in Bangalore. And it's corrupted, you know, if you will, it's corrupted the system. The vitality of multi-party politics has just been muted, unfortunately. On the other hand, there's always hope, you know. I mean, meaning that there's always, they're forming new parties. I don't, you know, what can I say? You got to be a believer in the future. But politics, unfortunately, has been side glance. The main important point, I think, for us is to really be skeptical when we're sold a bill of goods to suggest that cities, you know, places, particularly in the global south, if they're more like us, they can be more, you know, in a sense, like us. First of all, it lacks a strong historical sense of reflection on us. Maybe our history was not like that. And it also, it puts an undue burden on them, in a sense that this is not how a city thrives in India. A city does not thrive on outside capital coming in and buying up property. A city thrives, like, in the marketplace. A city thrives on a cheap way of living and bartering and buying and selling and making and producing. Once that dynamic economy gets squelched because real estate and IT become king, then you're eliminating the possibilities for a large percentage of the population. And it becomes, you know, it becomes the worst nightmare. How do we end on an upbeat note?
Hi.
Yeah.
First of all, thank you very much for the presentation. I think you highlighted a lot of really good key points and something that we should all watch out for. I guess for me, when I think about this, it really reminds me of the industrialization and the technology that happened, the technology that replaced the workers in Europe and in the U.S. So I was wondering, what are you thinking about that? And also, maybe this is just a way of, I mean, economy is clearly in a transformation, and any transformation is very difficult. So I guess, what are your thoughts on that? And I guess the big question here is, what do you see for the future? And do you see that maybe they should just change the whole idea and just keep the focus on farming? And does that have the future? Maybe farming for the world and supply for the world so we don't have food crisis? Or should they go and transform in another way or find some sort of balance?
Yeah, well, that's a big one. No, thank you for the question. Yeah, you know, I don't want to compare it to other historical moments because I'm not prepared to, you know. I mean, I don't want to make sweeping generalizations. And I try to remain concrete. I'm talking about Bangalore, you know, at this moment. But I did want to emphasize the history of Bangalore because I'm quite enamored with its history, with its public sector government involvement in creating jobs, in creating public space, which people use in very interesting ways, including in democratic ways, the way in which every single day the streets are closed down for marches, for rallies, for protests. I mean, that's what I like about the Indian democracy. But that's being closed off, you know. So that's what scares me. That's what worries me. On the other hand, Indians, like anybody else, I mean, they've always had to improvise. So they're finding new ways to protest, closing down the expressways, closing down the IT corridor, cutting the cables. And they're doing that to get attention, to draw attention to the severity of the problem that exists. And I think that's democracy at its best. That is being able to express yourself in political ways to talk about change and not just vote. Because the voting system, temporarily at least, is malfunctioning, corrupt, you know. But people are expressing themselves in other ways. Secondly, is that the economies are struggling to survive. And if we can imagine pulling back, insisting that our U.S. companies act like good citizens, insisting that the World Bank not impose this world city model on places like Bangalore, if we can pull people back that we have control over, U.S. policy on the World Bank, U.S. companies to be good citizens, corporate responsibility, there's more oxygen in the room to talk about alternatives. I've been to, and I've helped organize, a number of forums inside Bangalore, all day long meetings, crowded, brimful, where people have concrete ideas that are basically, I'm repeating. You know, I'm the academic that can codify it for like a term paper for Monday. But I'm getting a lot of my ideas and information from people who are talking to me, who are talking in public forums, who are trying to say, this is not the Bangalore we want. And so what is the Bangalore we want? We don't want large wide roads. We don't want expressways. What we want is, you know, and I already mentioned it, you know, basically the ability to produce in our industries, in our neighborhoods, in ways that can keep us in our neighborhood. It's really interesting. Micro economies. I have a friend in India who's studying the textile industry, producing now shirts for Gap. It used to produce shirts, high-end shirts, including silks, but now it's sort of like a sweatshop. For Gap, among others. But what's really interesting, he studied it, is that basically it's all neighborhood-based. Most of its resources, most of its employees, most of its energy consumption is quite minimal and relegated to neighborhoods. Each neighborhood has a different set of industries, workshops, what have you. It's incredibly energy efficient. It's incredibly sustainable in the sense that it consumes a little, very little tar, concrete, very little electricity, very little, you know, the materials that we require to build an airport and an expressway, an IT corridor, a golf course, and whatever. For a small amount of infusion, if the government can coddle those industries, people could live well in Bangalore again. If you can ensure that the schools are funded, that they continue to produce the engineers, that they continue to go to the public sector jobs, that guarantee housing. Right now, housing is the biggest problem. Most of the people who live in slums are productive workers who don't have the money to live in a house. Housing is so outrageously expensive, okay? So you can, it's not where the deadbeats live, you know what I mean? It's not where the people who don't work live, except for the displaced farmers. It's where highly productive individuals who cannot afford to live in Bangalore, well, I can imagine setting up public housing. Not like Chicago, you know, in that highly segregated, highly racist, highly class-based way, the way they did it before. These colonies where you had multi-class living quarters. Now, it didn't mean that they lived together. You used to have a highly class-divided, caste-divided society. But they lived in ways that were decent, that were livable, that were sustainable. That could be brought back. But it can't be brought back until the city stops borrowing money, dollars, to build this infrastructure, because it should work in the rupee investment. I'll give you one example, then I'll stop. A French company was brought in under the assistance of the World Bank to rebuild the water system. 8 million people from a town of 2 million, the water system's broke. Most people don't get access to water from the public system. So what did the French company do? First of all, it fired all the Indian contractors. And I said, well, what is a water system? It's just a big hole in the ground. You put big pipes. You have a water filtration plant. Why do you need French and Swiss and German technologists? He laughed, but he said, well, he said we can do it more efficiently through the French system. I said, well, the pipes. Where did the pipes used to come from? You know, the big pipes of the water mains. They said, well, there's an Indian company in town that used to make them. I said, well, did you hire them? He said, no. The Chinese offered, you know, 40% discount, and we now ship it in from China. So you can imagine a government policy that gives incentives to actually hire local industry to build the water system itself, to manage itself, to not hire the French, to bring in the cheaper Chinese goods, and you can have a world city, you know? So that's the narrative that I would take, is that the Bangalore was a world city, and it's been destroyed. Or is being destroyed through this sort of import of the world city model. Anyway, I think there's plenty of hope. Why? Because this is what I get from people in Bangalore itself. It's not my just spinning my optimistic wheels. You know, this is what people are actually trying to get in place, but you could see why it would not be attractive to people, government officials who have been sort of seduced by the idea of we could become Dubai or we could become Singapore. Thank you very much for your patience. And I suggest that you all become good public citizens, watch the debate, bring tomatoes, you know, express yourself, don't agree, you know. Thanks a lot.
Thank you all for coming this evening. Let's thank Michael Goldman one more time for being here. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks. It was great.
Is that okay?
It was great.